This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk, in for Mike Collins. One of the catchiest phrases in British history has taken on a new meaning: keep calm and carry on. The British government originally coined that phrase and put it on posters during World War II. Now, the tagline could certainly apply to the economic and political turmoil emanating from Brexit. This morning, we'll examine how the UK's vote to leave the European Union could impact Charlotte, from big banks to small manufacturers to local politics. We're joined in studio by Jay Bryson, Managing Director and Global Economist at Wells Fargo Securities. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you, Michael.
Mark Walker is on the board of the British American Business Council of North Carolina. He's also a private wealth advisor at Walker & Associates. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Ken Minkhaus is a political science professor at Davidson College. Welcome to you too, Ken.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's begin with some basics on how connected Charlotte and the United Kingdom are. Mark, how would you characterize that relationship from a business standpoint?
Well, it's very strong. You know, Charlotte's an international city. We have a number of international businesses that represented from a lot of EU nations, but also from the UK perspective, we have a robust group of companies that are operating here. And in terms of we also have the British American Business Council that promotes transatlantic trade between the between the UK and North Carolina. So we've really got a very strong environment here right now.
And that council, is it, trade, helping businesses come back and forth? What all do you guys do?
Well, I like to say this: resource awareness. We put the people in the room that are doing it already, along with companies that are looking for that expertise, and get all the people there in place so that resources are available and they can see exactly where they can go from there.
From the Charlotte Chamber and the Charlotte Regional Partnership, they list that there are more than 100 businesses from the UK that have operations in Mecklenburg County. And among foreign countries, only Germany has a larger presence. Could you give just a couple examples of some of the companies that we do have here?
Yeah, sure. Compass Group is one of our largest employers, about 4,000 employees in the area.
And they basically do a variety of food services kinds of things?
That's right. Food services and cafeteria management, arenas, hospitals. And they also run a number of fine dining restaurants as well. Also in arenas, museums, et cetera. BAE Systems, which is one of the largest defense contractors in the world, has a presence here as well. That's also one of our great sponsors at the British American Business Council. Britax, which manufactures mobile safety equipment for children, car seats, et cetera, and strollers. LexisNexis, which is providing a lot of support to corporations and legal professional services as they research different items.
And I was interested in, as well, and you mentioned the child seat manufacturing, and also one of the historic textile manufacturers, Coats of North America, has even had a place here for a while. What is it that makes this area attractive to British companies?
Well, I think it is an international city, and there's a lot here. As we say in our tagline, Charlotte's got a lot, and North Carolina also has very much a connection to the UK. We've got daily flights to Europe. The access to number of thousands, millions of people from our Charlotte area airport, and being able to reach most of the country within a shorter time period on the Eastern Seaboard. And that gives a lot of comfort to know that you can travel back and forth and then get where you need to go, if it's not Charlotte, to other cities in the United States as well.
Charlotte is also a major banking hub, as Wells Fargo and Bank of America are two of the largest employers here. Jay, how important is the UK to the banks?
The UK is certainly one of, speaking from Wells Fargo's standpoint, when we look at our international sort of business, the UK would be one of our biggest sort of areas of foreign sort of operations. We have a very large branch in London where we do a lot of business out of that particular sort of branch. Not familiar with Bank of America, but I would imagine, given the fact that, they're a large international bank, I'm sure they have a very large presence in London as well.
And why is it that that is a place that is good to have a big presence.
Well, it's the financial capital of Europe. And the reason it is the financial capital of Europe, a lot of it has to do with history. It always has been. And so you have an infrastructure there of people who know the financial services industry. They're all located there. There's a critical mass of those people who live there. And moreover, you know, with the EU, there's what's so-called the EU sort of passport. So if you're a bank or any business, for that matter of fact, you know, you can set up operations in a particular country, say the UK or in London, and that allows you then free access to all 27 other countries within in the EU. So that's why London has been that financial capital of Europe for a very, very long time.
So it really is, you know, the phrase that I've heard tossed around in research for this is a financial gateway. It really is a gateway to Europe because of the EU setup.
That's correct. I mean, obviously there's other financial capitals within Europe, you know, whether it's Frankfurt or whether it's Paris or places like that, but they're really the crown jewel of all of them is London. It's obviously the largest.
And do we have a rough idea of how many employees that, you know, say Wells Fargo or the other banks would have over there? Is it hundreds, thousands?
So with our branch in London, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it's in the order of 900, 1,000, somewhere in that sort of area. But some of the other larger banks in the country, like say if it's a JP Morgan or something like that, they would have thousands of people based in London.
And Ken, I'd also like to talk about just how politically connected this area is to the UK.
There's not anything directly politically connected that would be unique between North Carolina or Charlotte and the UK. I think the bigger issue is the extent to which the Brexit vote could potentially have spillover into North Carolina politics and elections. And that's a broad question we can get into if you'd like.
Let's start a little bit on that. I mean, what are the things that you think could make a spillover likely?
Well, first of all, it's probably unlikely to the extent that there are not that many Americans who take their cues from foreign policy in general or from political trends in other countries to help them decide how to vote. That's just never been the case. Spillover has happened in other settings. We've had two just in the past quarter century. The end of the Cold War, where we had popular uprisings against communist regimes across Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, was a great example of spillover from one country to the next. More recently, we've had the Arab uprisings or the Arab Spring in 2011, which was very much a contagion effect starting in Tunisia and then spreading across a whole region. I don't see that happening so much in this case. For one thing, we're talking about democracies, not uprisings against authoritarian regimes. For another thing, the kind of frustration with government and alienation that we have seen manifested itself in Brexit and in some of the current campaigns for the 2016 presidential election, they split between Democrats and Republicans. It's not a party movement. So even if Americans or North Carolinians did take their cue from the Brexit vote one way or the other, it would probably be a wash.
Because of just the even split between which party you identify with. Well, let's make sure to define what this Brexit vote was. I mean, what exactly was the UK voting on a few weeks ago?
What they were voting on is separation from the European Union. And so they've been members of the European Union now for 40-some years. And they have a free trade in goods and services. They have free movement of peoples across there. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people there voted is because of the immigration sort of things that are going on. And so what happens now is – and keep in mind, this referendum was not legally binding. The only body that can take the UK out of the EU is Parliament itself. And so Parliament now has to decide, and I would think they will at some point in the next few months will do that. They will invoke an article of an EU treaty that says we want out, and then they have to begin a negotiation of what the terms of that separation is going to be. So at this point, the UK is still in the European Union. They will remain within the European Union until those articles of separation come about, and that could be a few years from now. But you know, if you fast forward this, say, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, the trading relationship that the UK has with the European Union and its immigration sort of status, it probably will be different than what it is now.
And Mark, you're a British citizen. How did we get here? I mean, Jay just mentioned it's been in the Union for more than 40 years. I mean, how do you get to this point that there's this decision among the population to leave?
Well, it really comes down to a couple of things. Like Jay was just talking about, labor force movement and jobs. And you start to look at jobs, both camps were trying to influence the votes from the data. And Boris Johnson riding around with a double-decker bus with, we're going to provide 350 million euros every day to the EU. How would it be better spent here in the UK? And these are things that start to, work on the voters to think about these items and where the money's going and can we create more jobs? And so these types of things lead to decisions. And, from an economic perspective, we start looking into it to see what the ramifications are. But the elected officials in the UK, and then you've also got the EU that is driving some decisions that hasn't sat that well in the UK voters.
Were you surprised just from, the folks back home and the people that you talked to, were you surprised that it ended up going the way it did?
Absolutely, yes. I thought that the stay vote would be there. And in talking to my family, which mostly is still there, that was sort of where they thought things were going as well.
Are they mostly in a particular city or are they spread out?
They're spread out. My father's just off the Welsh border in the Shropshire area, and along with my stepmother, and then got stepbrothers and sisters, aunts and uncles scattered around the UK, and even have some family that has now moved to Spain. And that has implications as, what status will they have as citizenship? What does that look like? And will they be able to remain? Will they have to apply for EU citizenship? So I think all of this has to be worked out. One of the things that's created in every angle of this is the uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen. We don't know exactly, what the UK is going to do. Will they actually leave? And that is, let Ken expand upon that from a political standpoint, but also what the EU will look like if the UK is out and who will follow on. But these are things that have yet to be debated and compromises and agreements made, including trade agreements, which I think is the more daunting task about leaving at this point.
Ken, were you also surprised by the decision?
I was. I expected it to be close. Most of the pollsters thought that the stay would prevail barely. I think what we got wrong was the extent to which at least part of the population in the UK saw this as a protest vote. And that's what we're trying to unpack right now, just figuring out why it is that so many people in different categories, and they voted along very different lines. Older generation tended to be more leave, younger stay, more cosmopolitan areas like London were much more in favor of staying, countryside less so. But they had trying to figure out what it was that they were protesting against is really critical. And I think, it's a populist moment right now in Europe, in the United States, in other parts of the world. And we need to be paying attention to the grievances that are being articulated. In the case of the UK, I think the big three were concerns and fears about immigration, jobs, and then the distant EU bureaucracy over which they felt they had little control.
We need to take a short break. We'll be right back and really get into how this vote could impact this area. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Firehouse Casual Living Stores. Serving the Carolinas for nearly 40 years, Woodard & Castell Outdoor Furniture is featured among other brands. Showrooms at Johnston Road and W.T. Harris Boulevard. FHCasual.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, it's the local news roundup. North Carolina was center stage in the presidential race. Hillary Clinton and President Obama tag-teamed in Charlotte, attacking Donald Trump, who unloaded on Clinton at a campaign stop in Raleigh. The General Assembly has adjourned for the year, leaving the hot-button parts of House Bill 2 intact. The Department of Justice asked a judge to stop that controversial law from being implemented. And the feds say changes are needed before the Whitewater Center can return to normal. Those stories and more when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Obama administration moved this week to loosen controls on medication that eases opioid cravings. Pfizer announced it's changing how it markets the drugs to warn of risks, the latest in the nationwide effort to combat opioid addiction.
The Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon on listener-supported public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk, in for Mike Collins. When British Prime Minister David Cameron announced his resignation after the Brexit vote, he tried to reassure people and the markets about what the vote meant.
There will be no initial change in the way our people can travel, in the way our goods can move, or the way our services can be sold.
A board member of the British American Business Council of North Carolina, Mark Walker, is with us this morning. Mark, could there be a change in those things over time?
Well, I have to admit, it was one of the first things when I saw the vote come in about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I wondered about my UK passport whether or not I'd still be able to, you know, visit my father and other relatives and in the UK, and more importantly, get back to the US, because obviously I've made this my home at this point. But on a more immediate basis, there's been no change at this point, and will movement be restricted? I think this is part of the actual discussions moving forward that have got to come out of these agreements. You know, it's all part of the uncertainty that is there. On a travel note, if you haven't visited the UK in a while, it would be probably an excellent time to do that, given the decline in the pound sterling relative to the dollar. And, you know, with American Airlines direct flights daily, you can head over and see that for yourself. But, you know, economic activity never stops. It slows, it grows. And I think that's the key thing to be important. As we move through these things and reflect upon what's going on, that trade and commerce still will continue. It's a question of how it will continue and how politically some of these deals and arrangements will work out.
Wells Fargo global economist Jay Bryson is also with us this morning. On that point, Jay, that Mark just left off on, you know, could there be a change in how British goods move in that side of the equation?
Well, in the near – so there won't be any change how British goods moves between the United States and the UK. That doesn't change here. What changes is how these goods potentially could move between the UK and the European Union. 45% of UK exports go to the European Union. So it's, you know, roughly half of their exports there. And that won't change in the near term. Mark has kept using this word as uncertainty here. The uncertainty is for a business is what's the trading relationship going to look like a few years from now. And so I think the first impact that you see on the UK is investment spending there declines. You know, if you're a business and you're thinking about expanding in the UK, now's probably a good time to put those plans on hold until you see how this uncertainty plays out. And that, in our view, will probably cause a mild UK recession later this year, early next year.
Even before the full change is going to
happen. Before the full change, because businesses are forward looking. And I mean, you're seeing this in the city of London right now, the financial capital of the EU. There's all sorts of financial institutions there who are putting their expansion plans on hold. And then, you know, if you go one circle out from that, if you're a developer and you're thinking about putting up a new office tower there to house new people, well, you're probably going to put that on hold as well. So it takes effect kind of immediately. The uncertainty effects take effect immediately, even though these trading relationships will remain in place for a while. It's just the uncertainty of what they look like 2, 3, 4 years from now.
And so the how goods move throughout Europe, obviously coming out of that free trade bloc, would be affected. As of now, though, is the United States trading relationship essentially based on UK's membership in the EU? I remember President Obama earlier this year when he was discussing this, when asked about it, he said, you know, the UK would get in the back of the line in figuring out what our new trade agreement would be.
Right. So what we have, the trading relationship the United States has with the EU right now is based on World Trade Organization sort of rules. And so we have very low tariffs on most goods that go back and forth between the United States and the European Union, but they're not zero in many cases. Whereas the UK has zero tariffs with other members of the EU. And so at some point, so the fallback position here for the United States and the UK would just be to continue along those World Trade Organization sort of rules, very low tariffs, but in some cases, maybe not zero sort of tariffs. What the UK would really like perhaps would be some sort of free trade agreement with the United States, zero sort of tariffs. And that's what President Obama was referring to before, kind of getting in the back of the line. We've got this what's called TTIP sort of relationship going on, negotiations going on with Europe right now or the EU. And if the UK is not part of the EU, then they wouldn't benefit from that if that were to pass a few years from now.
And this idea of tariffs, I mean, obviously it's been a big part of the U.S. presidential campaign so far with, you know, Donald Trump calling for potentially some more substantial ones, Hillary Clinton basically taking more of a continuation of Obama's policies as far as free trade with some exceptions. Could there, you know, Ken, from Davidson College, I mean, could there be new tariffs that would affect the U.S. and U.K.'s trade relationship?
That's beyond my pay grade to know. I defer to my colleagues who follow these things more closely. I would say that the whole debate over tariffs and free trade, the free movement also of services, you know, and people, is part of a much broader conversation about globalization, to use an overused term. And I think that's where the comparison between the UK and the US and North Carolina in particular gets really interesting, because this does create winners and losers. And the people who have not benefited from free trade and free movement of goods and services are a big part of that voice to leave the European Union. And we've got something roughly similar here in North Carolina. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the election. We have the I-85 corridor, which has been a big winner in many, many ways. And then we've got the rest of the state that has been deindustrialized, that has lost jobs, that is profoundly depressed. And so the comparison is interesting to look at.
And to me, if a big part of the vote was frustration with free trade, how is it that the way this could end up working out a couple years down the road is we basically still have the same free trade? I mean, that would seem to go against what folks were voting for.
Well, yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in terms of the politics of the UK. I mean, the first thing that has to happen is the Conservative Party there has to elect a new member. And we're getting closer to that. We don't know who that leader is going to be yet. And that person will become the next prime minister. And so it really depends on how much that person really wants to pursue, what sort of negotiations they want to pursue with the rest of the European Union. Do they want to maintain a free trading relationship with the rest of the European Union? That's an option. But with that comes potential cost with that sort of relationship as well. So it's really going to depend upon the political response to this referendum vote there.
And Mark, what have you guys been hearing from, you know, I wonder if there have been questions coming specifically to the council or just in general you've been hearing from other British businesses that are in this area or are in North Carolina since the vote?
Yes. You know, in terms of when we look at, if we zoom out on North Carolina a little bit, we are a large trading partner with the UK. And in fact, the UK is about seventh on the list as far as destination for where North Carolina goods and services actually go to. And in total exports in North Carolina last year was about $30 billion. And so being seventh on that list, the UK-North Carolina relationship is very important. As an exporter with a stronger dollar, and you start to wonder about currency and currency conversion and how to address some of these risks in your business plan. Right? Businesses and leaders, when they're making capital investment decisions as, you know, personal individuals should look at these things on a long-term perspective and build that business case for why you want to invest internationally, why you want to have these outlets for your business. And the challenge today is, with so much uncertainty, is how do you navigate that? It really gets down to leadership, and that's where the BABC is really trying to provide those resources and get the people connected that have the answers, whether it's from a member of our board that is on the legal team that can help navigate these relationships. That's really our role, is to solve some of this, you know, problems that are coming up for our member companies and get those resources aligned so the questions get answered.
And with the size of that trade going back and forth, I mean, so is there, as of now, can you tell a particular effect on manufacturing as just like one place to start, an industry that, you know, we have some British manufacturers here. Obviously, we have some manufacturers here who ship abroad. Do we know yet how that may shake out in the course of these things?
Well, my guess would be in the very, very short term here, very, very little effect at all. I mean, so if you're a British business and you've set up operations here in the United States, why have you done that? Really, it's to serve the U.S. market here, right? And so the extent that the U.S. market isn't affected by that, those British businesses won't be affected. If you're exporting to the U.K., what effects could you see here? Well, suddenly the dollar now is a lot stronger versus the pound. So that's going to make your exports more expensive, and that's going to reduce your demand for your goods and services. Also, if there is, in fact, a recession in the U.K. or even a slowdown later this year, with a slowdown in the economy, the demand for those goods and services aren't going to be as big as well. So if you are an American business exporting a lot to the U.K., you probably could see it at the end, by the end of the year. But if you look at the whole United States, only 4% of our exports go to the U.K. And so as a percent of our GDP, that's less than 0.5% of our GDP. It's essentially a drop in the bucket. So if there's a recession in the U.K., is that going to cause a recession in the United States? No, not directly.
And we've already mentioned a couple of times the drop in the value of the pound versus the dollar. To some degree, is that change in itself, one of the most concrete things we've seen so far, and B, one of the things that's just most important when it comes to how goods actually move because of the effect on exports and imports?
Yes. I mean, there's been two big effects in the financial markets since then. First is the drop in the pound. It's down about 10% or so versus the dollar. The other thing was right in the immediate aftermath of the vote, we saw the stock market here in the United States go down pretty significantly, maybe 5% over the course of 2 days. That's pretty much regained all of its lost ground. So the big effect that the lasting effect 10 days or whatever it is after the vote is we've got the pound is weaker, and that will help British exports over time because they become more competitive, and it will dampen any sort of recession that they have in there. So that's probably the biggest thing. But in the near term, as we mentioned earlier, this uncertainty and the effect that has on the investment climate there is pretty big.
Could that though make being a British business and operating in North America less attractive because it's now more expensive to do business here because of the dollar?
Well, so most studies that look at these sort of things would say that the value of the dollar plays a role, but it's a relatively kind of minor sort of role. You know, most businesses locate to the United States, European business locate to the United States for strategic sort of reasons. It's a big market. And yeah, it's greater if, it's good for them if their currency is strong versus the dollar. They can buy more here than otherwise, but they're making most of those decisions based on big strategic sort of things. And, the value of the pound being weak versus the dollar, that may hurt on the margin, but I don't think it's going to cause British investment in the United States to completely collapse.
And on the stock market front, you mentioned how the broader market has made up most of, if not all, the ground that it lost initially. But the just volatility itself, I mean, does that tell you more about what we should see going forward with just the swings in the market that have resulted since?
Well, my guess would be you're probably going to continue to see volatility going forward. I mean, we have our own election coming up here in November, right? There's going to be some uncertainty ahead of that. And we just live in an more interconnected world right now. There's a lot of the world seems to be more unsettled than it has been for a very, very long period of time. And those things cause volatility, and you probably will see some volatility in markets.
And Mark, please.
Yeah, I would second that. And volatility certainly and uncertainty can cause you to have an emotional response to that. And I think it's important for companies and individual investors, that we advise to, take a step back and look at your overall plans and make sure the business case for why you're here, why have you invested, as a company in the United States, as Jay was saying, is a longer-term decision. And also, if you're investing personally, you want to think about these things as a longer-term investment decision as well. There are great companies that are in the UK as well as in the EU and the rest of the world. And if you're ignoring that, then you're limiting your portfolio and your investments to just the United States at that point. So I think it warrants a little bit more caution. It can be opportunistic if it fits as part of your overall plan. And but we're going to see uncertainty and continued volatility as we move through this. And it's a long process. You know, we've alluded to, and maybe Ken can expand upon, the actual process that we go through here with Article 50 at this point.
Ken, do you want to pick up there?
Well, I wouldn't be in a position to give details about how the UK is going to negotiate this exit, except to repeat what's already been said, which is to say that there's a lot of uncertainty about it. It's never been done. It's going to be the process of negotiation. There's speculation about how tough the European Union will be on the UK as a way of deterring other members who are potentially thinking about dropping out, to raise the cost, to make it unthinkable for anyone else to do that. But all this we don't know. And one of the things about uncertainty, which is the theme that we keep stressing here, but we haven't yet really underscored the fact that this isn't just about the UK. This is about the EU more broadly. There's an enormous amount of uncertainty about the broader impact it'll have on the EU. There are other member states who have populations that are very uneasy about the EU. There are exit movements in a few other countries. And so this could have much broader ramifications for a major trade and security and political partner of the United States for years to come. And that even includes the possibility of the UK breaking apart if Scotland, for instance, wants to go its own way and exit the United Kingdom and rejoin the European Union. The other thing about all this that has me worried when we talk about volatility is so much of the Brexit vote and so much of the more general populist moment that we are living in right now in the West and beyond reflects a very low level of public confidence in institutions. That everyone seems to think we're heading in the wrong direction. The polls repeat that over and over again, whether you're in Europe or the US or elsewhere. And that's bad news because ultimately we need confidence in functional governmental institutions for business, for security, for services, for everything. That to me is the really long-term and worrisome message coming out of the Brexit vote.
And it seems like we've had that trend, as you mentioned, in America as well. What are even the kinds of things that could turn that ship around?
Oh, my goodness. well, again, to go back to leadership, I think that's a big part of it. We need leaders in political parties who put the country first, who understand that bipartisanship is critical for passing of laws. And it's not just about who's going to game the next election to try to win a couple of extra seats. The short-term thinking that prevails right now in the U.S. Is very worrisome. And doesn't bode well. We've had paralyzed institutions.
We'll keep this conversation going and get to some of your comments after a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mille Lacs Jewelers, the Diamond Specialists, dedicated to teaching customers about diamonds, pearls, and gemstones to make an educated decision. Located at the Arboretum, MilleLacsJewelers.com, a diamond importer. Coming up in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, an African-American man is killed by police in Minnesota, the aftermath captured on video. The Justice Department investigates the shooting death of another black man by Baton Rouge police, the latest on the incidents and what they mean for race and policing. That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show ahead at 10 o'clock. We'll get back to Charlotte Talks in just a couple of seconds. If you'd like to join the conversation today about Brexit and its impact here at home in Charlotte, send us an email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, or search for WFAE on Facebook and at Charlotte Talks on Twitter. We're coming right back.
Presidential elections are historic, and All Things Considered has brought you 4 decades of election coverage.
Regardless of how you vote, I urge each of you to vote.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We're going to choose the last president of the 20th century and the first president of the 21st century.
Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
Once again, this election year, we bring you the political news of the day with perspective. Listen every afternoon.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk. We're discussing how the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union may impact Mecklenburg County and the economy more broadly. Ken Minkhouse is a political science professor at Davidson College. Jay Bryson is a global economist with Wells Fargo. And Mark Walker is on the board of the British American Business Council of North Carolina. We'd also love to hear your comments. Email charlottetalks at wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. One of the things we'd mentioned already is that, you know, the market took a fall, but then broadly speaking has mostly recovered. The bank stocks, however, are still a good deal lower than they were before the Brexit vote. Jay, you've already explained earlier in the show how we have the banks tend to have very large presences in the UK. You know, what could this potentially mean for the banks?
Well, you know, say a Wells Fargo, I'll use Wells Fargo because I'm associated with them, is a Wells Fargo going to completely pull out of the European Union, doing business in the European Union because of this? The answer is no, right? You know, whether or not we still have a large presence in London, say 5 years from now, don't know that, but we'll still have a presence in London, in Europe, whether it's in London, whether it's in Frankfurt or Paris or wherever, we'll still have that. So it's a matter of shifting your resources around. You know, would be a broader thing here, and that is if the Brexit vote somehow were to trigger some sort of global recession, then not only would the banks get hurt by that, but also all sorts of other companies and individuals as well. But as I said earlier, I think the probability that Brexit in and of itself leads to a global sort of recession, I just don't think is going to happen. It's just that the UK accounts for about 3-4% of global GDP. Even if it goes into a recession later on, it's just not big enough to pull everything up by itself to pull everything down with it. So in general, I think, you know, the banks will tend to be okay.
And essentially, it's a key market, but it's not, you know, such a large amount of our trade or our business that it in itself would cause, you know, bigger
right,
effect.
Right. So if you look at, say, our operations in London, so, you know, how much of that is going to be banking just individuals or companies within the United Kingdom? Don't know what that would be. But the reason we're in London is not just because of the UK market specifically. It's for all of Europe.
And potentially by that argument, there have been stories about, you know, maybe Frankfurt becomes the new EU banking capital. But it not necessarily that it would result in, okay, I'm an American bank, I'm going to employ fewer people in London. That doesn't necessarily mean layoffs. It could just mean those resources are moved to a different part of Europe.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. And then as far as just the size of British business here, I mean, as of now, only Germany has more businesses of its own that are based in Mecklenburg County. Is that something that over time we could see change because, you know, say there ends up resulting some kind of tariff, there ends up being some type of change in trade?
Well, what's happened over the last 13, 14 years is we've actually seen an increase of international businesses in Charlotte, whether it's been UK or German or other member nations. And we have 977 internationally owned businesses operating in the Charlotte region today. And according to the Chamber of Commerce International report, of that, 118 are UK businesses. So that's the second highest in that group. And going back to 2003, if we look at that number, the number was 74. So we've seen over a 50% increase in investment and business operations from the UK into North Carolina. And the same is true in our EU nations as well. So I think the trend has been positive, and I think if we look back over the last 13 years, it's been a rocky economic set of circumstances, and yet we've had economic activity. And businesses that want to trade and want to be a part of this market are going to make those long-term decisions to do this from a business case. And I think that's also true for individual investors. As you start to think about these headlines, it really can destroy what you're thinking about from an investment thesis based upon what you wake up to every morning. And you've got to look beyond that and create a longer-term plan. And that's true for individuals and businesses.
To some degree, just the speed and extent of globalization is something that has, you know, all the ships moving this direction, even with the Brexit vote.
Yes. I think that longer term, you know, trade's going to continue. Economic activity, like I was saying earlier, never really stops. It just continues at a possible lower level, or it could grow. And these are, you know, based upon, as we were alluding to earlier, leadership decisions. How can you influence the trade? You know, what can you do? Can you lower corporate income tax? Would that be beneficial? Both the UK has been doing that. Corporate tax rate has come down dramatically. And here in North Carolina, we're reducing our state corporate tax rate. These are things that North Carolina can control. And also, you know, as we look at tax rates worldwide, you know, you can influence economic activity through taxation.
Quickly on that, did the UK lower the corporate tax rate post-Brexit?
No, it's been going down. Yes, yeah, it's been a programmed decrease. And that's one of the tools that's available. So.
Jay?
I was just going to say, I think we're at a very interesting time here in terms of politically and how its interactions with the economics. I mean, we've been dealing now with a globalizing world for the last, say, three decades or so, since the Berlin Wall came down. That's what we have known over that three-decade period of time. And so if you look at what's happening in Europe right now, people becoming more and more populist, more and more nationalist. You look at what's happening here in the United States. I mean, we could wake up to a world, if you were Rip Van Winkle and you fall asleep and you come up awake 10 years from now, the world could potentially look different than it is right now. Just because globalization has moved in this one direction for so long doesn't necessarily mean the ship has to continue to move in that direction. It takes time to take the ship to change, but it definitely could lead to change. And so it'll be interesting to see politically how things play out. There's been winners, but there's clearly been losers from globalization as well. And, you know, if the losers become vocal enough, they could change the politics, not only here in the United States, but in Europe as well, and things could change.
And Ken, I feel like that's almost an exact little microcosm of what we've been seeing in our politics, both here in America and to some degree with this Brexit vote, how, you know, the losers of globalization seem to be voicing their opinions louder and louder in the ballot box.
Yes, and North Carolina, again, is a perfect example. We talk about all of the international firms coming to Charlotte. Charlotte's got so much to offer. It's expanding. It's a winner across the board. But if we were having the same conversation 40 miles north up in Hickory, where almost all the furniture factories have been closed down and the textile firms have been closed down, those people have been big losers. And Charlotte is part of North Carolina, and that's one of the, one of the tensions right now on a whole series of laws, including our bathrooms, as to how much attention we need to pay to the concerns, whether we agree with them or not, of the rest of the state of North Carolina, some of which is not doing well at all.
And could the angst from the losers, so to speak, could that is that rising to a level that it could result, you know, in the near future in different priorities being pushed by some of our leaders?
Well, it already has. I think that gets us back to populist politics. What we're seeing in the U.S., in the European Union, and elsewhere are politicians who are exploiting those anxieties. it's most visible with immigration and anti-immigrant sentiments, people feeling that immigrants are coming and taking their jobs, and that can be expressed in xenophobia or racist sentiments. And you know, these are what we have to condemn, the racism that is used in that, and we have to condemn the leaders who exploit that. But we also have to pay attention to the legitimate concerns beneath that, which are jobs. The people who are competing for low end jobs with immigrants are incredibly anxious about that, and that's a legitimate concern. I think just dismissing it as a bunch of know nothing racists misses part to the point that there are people who are suffering in the current globalized economy. We don't have answers. I think that's part of the frustration. And to go back to low levels of confidence in institutions, you know, we've talked about leadership, and I think that's key. But it's also the case that our leaders are facing unprecedented levels of problems. You know, the challenges for all of the wonderful benefits of globalization, it also presents challenges that I don't know anyone has answers for.
And what are some of the lessons that American politics or even North Carolina politics can take from, you know, this very clear message of how we've seen this play out with Brexit, the anti-immigrant sentiment, how that can play a big role in winning elections, the fears of globalization? I mean, what are the takeaways back home?
Well, for me, the big takeaway is we really need now to just talk about opinion shapers and elites, whether they're business elites or political elites or others. Changing some of the atmospherics in how they talk about the electorate, how they address problems. I think we have been remiss in not taking seriously the concerns of the portions of our population that have lost jobs or that have now have jobs that are much less secure, and start to focus more serious on that. Too often we've just dismissed it as people who just don't get it. And in fact, you know, they may not get all of this. I don't get all of the complications of trade and Brexit, but they certainly get it when it comes to putting bread on the table and not being able to. And that's I think that would be the first takeaway is the elites in Europe, in the UK, in the US, need to start listening a little bit more to the population that has missed out and is in a different boat than the rest of us right now.
And I wonder, too, if there are lessons as far as when it comes to the generational gap. I mean, Mark, you may know this data better than I do, but from the polling I saw after the Brexit vote, it seemed like the older folks in Britain were much more likely to vote to leave, while as the younger ones were much more likely to vote remain.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the polling data, and I think it was rather interesting in the vote. But I think that as Ken was alluding to, the issues of economics are complicated processes, and us as we when we are looking at these things, we tend to try to make these decisions, you know, and then you're asking, you know, a population to vote on economic policies, really, and these are complicated items, and I think it's difficult to understand those ramifications. And that's where elected leaders, as Ken was alluding to, have to step in and make these hard decisions and decide for the population with, you know, the vote and the intention of that as to what that policy should be to benefit the greater number of people. And that's difficult. That's what leadership is. It's not an easy thing to accomplish, but it's definitely something that is going to challenge world leaders and business leaders.
And Ken, do we have similar gaps when it comes to voting between generations currently here in America?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear from the polls that I've seen. And it also manifests itself in another overlapping category, and that is the urban-rural gap on these matters, whether it's the UK or the US. That's where you really see sizable gaps both in income, in cosmopolitanism, and preferences for, you know, for globalization or for, time to take our country back. And that's only accelerating. We're seeing it here in North Carolina, the gap between the big cities and the countryside. And I think that was very much the case with London and the rest, most of the rest. Scotland, of course, was also very much for staying in the UK.
And that's another example of how you can have areas of winners versus losers, because these metropolitan areas tend to do well when it comes to globalization.
Absolutely. Because metropolitan areas tend to be have more of a percentage of college-educated people than, say, rural areas do. And if you're a college-educated person in our country, generally you've done pretty well by globalization. If you're not college-educated, you probably haven't done quite as well.
We've talked a lot about how there's a uncertainty that remains with this. What are the key things for us to watch for when we'll start having more clarity? Is it the negotiations with the EU?
Well, I think the first thing you want to watch is the outcome of the leadership contest in the Conservative Party in the UK. We should know that in the next few weeks or so, how that whole thing's going to play out. Once you have a prime minister there, he or she will start to lay down their plans, what sort of negotiating process to take with the European Union. And those negotiations will probably start maybe later this year, maybe even early in 2017. So we kind of have a long way to go. But I think what we want to watch in the near term is, who's the new prime minister of the UK, and then what sort of responses are other European leaders like Chancellor Merkel or President Hollande? What are they saying? Are they going to take a hardline sort of approach to the UK in terms of negotiations, or is it more of a amicable sort of divorce that appears to be coming up?
And Mark, we began the show with you talking about how your first thoughts when you saw the vote at 2 a.m. was, I live in America. How could this change things for me? I mean, from your standpoint. For you personally, or for folks that you've talked to, has it changed any of what your thoughts are as far as staying in America or being able to travel back and forth?
No, I think it was more a reaction to the news, and I think that's what we saw initially in the markets as well, was that reaction immediately, and then as sort of a calming, keep calm and carry on, as you alluded to at the top of the hour, is really something that you have to remind yourself in any of these type of events that happen, and put a framework around it for what decision-making process. But emotion is certainly in this vote, and it was in decision-makings. And I think you've got to look beyond the headlines and instead, really focus in on what you're trying to accomplish. I love America. I love living here. And it's not altering my vote to stay.
That's all the time we have this morning. You just heard from Mark Walker. He's on the board of the British American Business Council of North Carolina. He's also a private wealth advisor at Walker & Associates. Jay Bryson is managing director and global economist at Wells Fargo. And Ken Minkhouse is a political science professor at Davidson College. Thank you all so much for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.